Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Kelly Henry, a Supervisory Assistant Federal Public Defender in Nashville, Tennessee, who has represented Tennessee's death row prisoners for more than 20 years. Ms. Henry was last year's recipient of the Justice John Paul Stevens Guiding Hand of Counsel Award given by the American Bar Association's Death Penalty Representation Project. Ms. Henry's lead counsel on the defense team that obtained a stay of execution for Oscar Franklin Smith, who was scheduled to be executed June 4th in Tennessee. The stay was granted in his case on the grounds that crucial work could not be done during the coronavirus pandemic without endangering the health and lives of the defense team, witnesses, and court and prison personnel involved in the clemency and execution processes. Ms. Henry also filed a motion on April 29 seeking to stay Byron Black's October 8, 2020 execution date, saying that the COVID-19 pandemic poses, quote, unprecedented challenges to the legal community and the courts, as well as to the public at large. We'll be discussing how the pandemic has affected the critical work that takes place in the months leading up to a scheduled execution, including final investigations and clemency efforts. Kelly Henry, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be with you.
When most people think about what goes on in advance of an execution, they conjure up images of last-minute litigation. But while there is, in fact, substantial end-stage litigation in capital cases, the supposed last-minute nature of that litigation is highly sensationalized. And there's much more to whether an execution should proceed in a pandemic than merely whether it's safe to carry out an execution. Now, I know you can't get into the specifics of what you and your colleagues are investigating in Mr. Smith's case and Mr. Black's case, but would you tell our listeners what the defense actually has to do at this stage of the case?
Certainly. And there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that, you know, the courts and the public never really see, because that work ends up being, you know, synthesized by our team and presented in our motions and pleadings to the court, as well as our presentations to the governor. So a 2-hour presentation to the governor in support of a clemency petition usually represents about, you know, 400 hours worth of field work on the part of the team. One of the things that happens when we begin to represent a client who is facing an actual execution date is that we begin a complete reinvestigation of the case. And the reason that we do this is because there were procedural technicalities that were barriers to the presentation of many of our clients' factual claims in federal habeas and in state post-conviction. And so when we get to this stage of the litigation, when we are presenting our case to a governor for executive clemency, those procedural technicalities are now irrelevant. And so work that may have not occurred earlier because it would have not borne fruit in a legal challenge is suddenly very important. And the reality is that lawyers miss things. And so when we look at a case 20 years after we began representation, we've learned more. Science has moved on. There are so many things that can be looked into and reinvestigated in a case. And that's our obligation to do so. A perfect example of that, Rob, was the Sedley Alley case in 2006. Mr. Alley was convicted of a sensationalized, horrific murder, and no lawyer had ever really investigated his innocence. They had just always said he was guilty but insane. Mr. Alley didn't have a memory of the night in question, and so he couldn't defend himself. And yet, when the legal team began a complete reinvestigation of his case after an execution date was sought, we discovered compelling evidence of innocence, which unfortunately we were never able to see through in the court during his lifetime.
How often do death row prisoners have significant issues still pending in their cases at the time that they get the warrant?
You know, in my experience, and I've been doing this work for about 30 years, it is the rare client who doesn't have serious litigation pending at the end. We are often challenging their conviction sentences or the method of execution in collateral proceedings. And so when an execution date is set and we have that collateral litigation that is ongoing, that speeds up markedly. Litigation that would take years suddenly has to be conducted in an extremely compressed period of time. You may recall in 2018, when the state of Tennessee requested execution dates for 10 men on Tennessee's death row, there was a challenge made to the new lethal injection protocol. And we were placed on what Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Sharon Lee both described as a rocket docket, and were forced to litigate that case in the course of 8 months. We took countless depositions, traveled all over the country, presented a 10-day trial with multiple expert witnesses, and had to conduct a full appellate process, including a request for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court, and a period of time that normally you would expect 5 years of litigation.
One of the things that I noticed in the 25 years when I was doing death penalty cases is that the public really doesn't have an accurate perception of the kinds of things that they're going on, especially around the time of a death warrant. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's this misperception that there's this just last minute activity. Now, there is last minute activity, but misperception is that defendants are waiting until the last minute to try to jam up the courts so there isn't a fair opportunity to review the cases. And my sense through the time in which I was doing cases is that, in fact, there hasn't been, in most cases, a fair opportunity to review the issues in the case, but that's had nothing to do with defense strategy. So there are key issues like ineffective representation or prosecutorial misconduct that courts have never looked at. Is that the same experience that you've had in Tennessee?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know of any lawyer who intentionally holds on to, you know, legal issues until the last minute. It's just not the case. That is a complete misperception. And as you say, there are issues of ineffective assistance of counsel that often come up, juror misconduct issues that are discovered at the last minute as jurors reveal for the first time their misconduct at the trial. Brady evidence is often found when we conduct these reinvestigations of cases. And that's happened in, you know, produced days multiple times over the course of my career. And then sometimes the law changes. So, you know, for years, it was held to be constitutional to execute individuals with intellectual disability under Henry versus Leno. And then in 2002, the law changed. Well, that law in, you know, Natkins versus Virginia was retroactive and applied to every person who was on death row with intellectual disability. That spawned, you know, a lot of litigation for many of our clients, certainly my clients, regarding their intellectual disability. That wasn't a last minute strategy. That was just a change in the law. And we see that happen oftentimes in our cases.
Now, there are some issues that, because of the way the law is written and the way the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the law, do have to be litigated at the end stage. And I know Byron Black has issues in his case, and we don't need to discuss the specifics of that, but that deal with his competency to be executed. And that's an issue that you can't litigate until there's a death warrant. So when you have that, what's the defense required to do?
Well, you're exactly right about that, Rob. And in Tennessee, we have a procedure which is extremely truncated. What we have to do is conduct an investigation of our client's current mental functioning, but that also requires looking back as to what his mental functioning has been throughout life, because we know that past mental illness is an indicator of current mental illness. And we want to see the course and progression of that mental illness through time. That requires us to review, synthesize, organize mounds of mental health records, institutional records. We want to look at their medical records, because oftentimes a medical issue can result in incompetence to be executed, as the Supreme Court recognized in Madison. And then we have to get expert witnesses, and those expert witnesses need to travel and see the client face to face. You can't conduct a mental health evaluation through Zoom. It has to be face to face, because the reason for that is the examiner has to be in the room to read facial cues, to see hesitation. We all know through our own Zoom experiences that we have problems using this technology even today. The internet is not perfect, and a examiner can't, you know, look at the client and understand whether or not there was a delay in the video or there was a physical tick that he observed in our client. So those examinations have to take place at the prison. And that's something that takes, you know, evaluations. In Mr. Black's case, although I can't go into a lot of the specifics, I did inform the court today that Byron is in need of neuroimaging studies. We know that he has organic brain damage. The state doesn't even doesn't dispute brain damage. The question is whether or not that brain damage is indicative of his intellectual disability. And we fought over that since 2002. But the question is, does he also have some sort of degenerative brain disease, some cognitive decline? And we need neuroimaging studies to determine whether or not there is vascular atrophy going on with Byron. To do that, he has to be transported from the prison to a facility that's capable of doing these sorts of evaluations. And we do those a lot in our cases. And typically it's routine, but in the era of the pandemic, nothing is routine.
That's a routine thing for the defense to need and for the defense to request. And oftentimes there are hurdles that make it hard to do in the best of social conditions. What's an expert able to do, if anything, in order to prepare for a competency evaluation during a pandemic?
Really, they can't. I mean, that's just a simple answer, because the court wants and needs an opinion about our client's current mental functioning, and the expert can't rely on what the lawyer tells them about her client's mental functioning, even if the lawyer could visit her client, which right now we can't. He has to see the client in person. No expert's going to give an opinion without having done an in-person evaluation. And that can't happen right now.
And that's not the only thing that can't happen right now. And I think it's, you know, the Oscar Smith stay motion that you filed is the most thorough description of the effects of COVID-19 pandemic on defense investigation, at least the most thorough of any of the motions that have been filed to date. I know it's in it, you know, you talk about how Tennessee, like most states, is under a stay-at-home order. And because of that, you say, and I'm quoting here, that the order has resulted in the loss of critical time needed to represent, in that case, Oscar Smith, but certainly the same thing with Byron Black and any other death row prisoner who's facing a warrant. Here's what the public, what folks have been saying to me, and I know it's the misconception that many folks have, and they don't understand this, but why can't investigative work just be done by phone?
Well, because we know from scientific studies and of human behavior that you're just not going to get the level of cooperation, the depth of information, and knowledge that you gain from an in-person interview. You know, there was actually an article circulated this morning about how even Zoom is ineffective in that way because of our inability to observe verbal cues that you see when you're in a room, the ability to have that nonverbal communication between two people that is so normal to us that we take it for granted, but really is the key to human communication and interaction. It's so easy when you're speaking to someone on the phone, particularly these days in a world where we have, you know, tablets and phones and computers, to have a conversation with someone on the phone while at the same time you're checking your email or checking a text or you're distracted by something else and you just want to get off the phone, versus a human being coming to the door, sitting down, having a cup of coffee over the kitchen table and having a frank, outright discussion. That's just a completely different experience. And we know, because we have seen what happens when defense teams that came before us in our cases did conduct investigation by telephone, when those investigators didn't get up out of their office and go out into the field. They missed so many important stories. I had an example of that in a case recently where the trial team did not have an in-person interview with a witness who was the client's cousin. They deemed this person to be not terribly important. And when we went and sat down with this individual face to face, he told us that our client had confessed to him that her mother had sexually trafficked her, that she was a human trafficking victim. And he went on to provide incredible detail. That conversation would not have happened over the telephone. That conversation happened by building trust and rapport between the defense team and the witness. And we have to have that in every single case. There are no shortcuts. And when you start the conversation with somebody on the phone, you've already lost that witness. We have to meet them face to face.
I think one of the things folks really don't understand, it happens all the time, it's happened in a number of my cases, is how you have to build a rapport, not just with the client, but with the family members and the witnesses. Because a lot of what we say, or what I used to say when I was doing cases, has to do with letting the public know, letting the courts know, letting the judge know some of the worst things that ever happened in a person's life. I hear these stories all the time from lawyers who are doing the cases, and it happened to me when I was doing the cases, where you go into somebody's house and there's reluctance to talk to you, and you finally break down the barriers and you start talking to a person, and you notice you ask them a question and they look to the side. And you're like, well, what's that about? They start to talk and then they stop and they look to the side again. And you realize that they're about to tell you a story about the father or a stepfather or somebody doing a horrible act, and that person's in the house. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that you just don't know about and can't know about if you're doing the interview by phone.
Oh, that's such an excellent example, Rob. Sometimes you get the verbal cue that the witness wants to tell you more, but they just can't that day. And so you know to come back. If you talk to that witness over the phone and you didn't see that nonverbal cue, you might end the conversation too early and never return to that witness, not knowing the information that that witness holds that's so important to your client. And, you know, a lot of people ask us, well, why didn't your client tell you these things? Well, we know, one, that our clients feel shame for a lot of what has happened in their life. And also, quite frankly, trauma is a disease of memory. And our clients often cannot remember all of the horrible details of what they experienced growing up. But that information, you know, what happened to them is a part of who they are and contributed to how they got into the situation that they were in. Those are my clients who, you know, don't challenge their guilt, innocence. You know, how did they get here? What happened to them? That information is crucially important to the decision maker in an executive clemency proceeding. And as I was mentioning earlier, oftentimes that information is never thoroughly discussed in federal court because of procedural technicalities and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act's limitations on relief in federal court. But in executive clemency, you can bring those stories to light and you can make your client and his family come alive to the governor or whoever the decision maker is on clemency and have them see the whole person. And that's an extraordinary opportunity. It's a gift that our clients give to us when they allow us to tell these stories. But we can't tell the stories if we don't have the facts. And we can't get the facts if we can't do the investigation.
So here we are. We're at a stage where access to critical information isn't available because you can't get to the people who might have that information. How are you able to communicate with clients right now?
Well, it's extremely difficult. There is no real guarantee of attorney-client privilege through any telephone call that we have with our clients. Those phone calls are brief. It's difficult for the phone calls to even get through because, you know, we aren't working in the office and our telephone system isn't really set up to forward our calls very effectively. We were the government and it's an old phone system. You know, and our clients can't put our personal cell phone numbers on their list. So, you know, having our clients speak to us is extremely difficult. The prison now has, you know, eliminated all legal visits. And I don't criticize the prison for that. They're right to end legal visits for now because of this pandemic. You know, if it was another situation, I would be the first one, you know, at the courthouse steps complaining about being denied access to my client. But my client's safety has to come first, as does the safety of the community. And this just isn't about just the client. It's about, you know, the corrections officers. It's about the people in my office. It's about the family members of the corrections officers, the family members of people in my office, the people that they will come into contact with. You know, this pandemic is like nothing any of us has ever experienced in our lifetimes. And, you know, I pray to God that we never experience it again. And we're learning a lot on the fly, but what every government official agrees is that we have to social distance. We have to minimize in-person contact because that is what is needed to save lives. And so it's not about our client being executed. You know, it's about saving lives. And, you know, my staff love their clients and, you know, they will do anything for their clients. They will move heaven and earth. They will work, you know, 24 hours a day if they need to. None of us ever complains about that. But we can't ask our workers, our investigators, our paralegals, our attorneys to possibly submit themselves to a death sentence or a death sentence to someone in their family because they caught this virus during this time when it's avoidable, when they could stay home.
I've gotten a number of questions from reporters about why isn't this just another attempt to delay an execution. And, you know, you've now explained the significance of the clemency process, and there have been close to 300 grants of clemency in death penalty cases. But there are also a lot of very substantive issues, issues about whether someone should have been sentenced to death. You talked earlier about Sedley Alley. Now, Sedley Alley, there is really strong circumstantial evidence now that he's innocent. And in fact, it's more than circumstantial evidence. There's some forensic evidence as well. You guys went into court representing, and when I say you guys, I mean the Federal Defender's Office and the Innocence Project and local counsel who were representing Sedley Alley's daughter. You went into court asking for DNA testing. Can you tell us briefly what happened there?
Sure. And I will, I've said this many times and I believe it, I will go to my grave believing that Sedley is innocent unless DNA proves me wrong. You know, Sedley was an incredibly mentally ill man who also had a drug and alcohol problem. And we've seen it in, and, you know, the Supreme Court has even recognized in cases of mental retardation that mental retardation puts people at special risk for wrongful execution. Well, so does mental illness. And that's what happened in Sedley's case because he had no memory of the events of the night of the murder. And so he couldn't defend himself. And his lawyers just assumed he was guilty and never looked back. When we reinvestigated the case in 2006, we realized that there was proof that had been withheld that would have established an alibi, a rock solid alibi for Sedley at the time the homicide took place. And then we dug further and we saw that Sedley in no way matched the description of the man who abducted Suzanne Collins. That man was about 5'9". Sedley was over 6 feet tall. We discovered that the victim had two boyfriends, one that was secret to the other, and that she had just broken off with that boyfriend in Millington, Tennessee, and was set to return to California the next day to be with her fiance. The jilted boyfriend matches perfectly the description of the person who abducted Suzanne Collins and drove the same kind of car that was used in the abduction of Suzanne Collins. It's evidence like that that we were beginning to uncover, you know, tire tread evidence, footprint evidence, all sorts of things that, you know, a trial lawyer, a trained trial lawyer would have known to look for, but that no one had looked at before. We tried to get the DNA tested in the case. The Innocence Project, as you mentioned, came in. We conducted a clemency hearing before a board that was appointed by Republican governors. And that board recommended to the governor at the time a reprieve for Sedley. And the board actually recommended to the governor that he should order the DNA to be tested. The governor did half of that. He gave us a reprieve and told us to go back to court in Shelby County, Memphis, Tennessee. And we were denied evidence under a legal theory which has now been overturned by our Tennessee Supreme Court. So the law that was used prohibits Sedley from getting DNA at the time of his execution is no more. Given that change in the law and the discovery of a man who was arrested in St. Louis, Missouri, who is thought to possibly be a serial killer, who mentioned on his LinkedIn webpage his presence at the Millington Air Force Base during the time frame that Suzanne Collins was a student there and during the time frame that she was murdered. We went to April and told her we had this new evidence, and we went to court. Because she, standing in the place of her father and representing the estate, wants to know the truth. She has lived with this hanging over her head her entire life. It has destroyed her world and that of her brothers. And the not knowing is worse than anything else. And they just want an answer. And so that case is proceeding through the courts right now. And we hope she gets the answer and the justice she deserves. And that Sedley deserves.
I think Sedley Alley's case illustrates both the promise and the sometimes ineffectiveness of the clemency process. Because here you have, you've got a case where for a variety of reasons, and the evidence was never developed in the courts. And after someone is convicted, the legal standard for getting off of death row is very different from the standard for getting onto death row. So you almost have insurmountable burdens of proving that you are innocent, whereas at trial, the burden is on the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt to show that you're guilty. So I think Sedley Alley's case is a really strong example of how through the clemency process, you can get additional review. But the downside of it was that all there was additional review, and then the courts didn't follow through.
Exactly. And again, just because of procedural hurdles and, as you say, the insurmountable obstacles that are placed in our way. And that's why, frankly, it does take so much time, because once you make these discoveries, then you have to, you know, dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and you have to do it very, very quickly. And then suddenly you realize, oh my God, look what got missed. Today, there's an article posted in the appeal about my client, Purvis Payne, who also has an execution date in December of this year. And Purvis was, arrested for a crime that occurred, interestingly enough, in Millington, Tennessee. And the crime occurred a year after the Suzanne Collins murder. He was convicted in Shelby County, even though he has always maintained his innocence. And he is a person with intellectual disability that the Tennessee court have refused to give a hearing. And so here we have the intellectually disabled man, wrongfully convicted. The new team on his case, who took over after his lawyers of 18 years left our office. So we did a new investigation of the case, the new team, and we went down to Shelby County and asked them to produce the evidence in the case. And lo and behold, there's forensic evidence that we never knew existed that's inconsistent with the prosecution's theory, DNA that could be tested and demonstrate Purvis's innocence. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens in these cases. And it's not intentional, and it's not because the lawyers who came before were bad lawyers, or because, you know, my team is so great. I'm certain that, you know, I've made plenty of mistakes along the way in my career. The point is that we're all humans and we miss things, but we can't allow our human errors to produce a wrongful execution. We have to do everything we can to right those wrongs as long as we can and as long as our client draws breath. And in Sedley's case, that was until the very end. We were still writing a cert petition when we got word that Sedley was executed at 1 a.m.
I want to shift gears here for a second. I kind of think that the listeners might need a break from the really traumatic and emotional kinds of things that that we come across in these cases. So let's shift a little bit to process and going forward, how courts have been effective or ineffective in responding to the pandemic. We've seen courts canceling a lot of proceedings and moving others to phone or video. Do you think the courts have been sufficiently responsive with important issues like, for example, your stay matters?
I think I'll reframe your question just a little bit or respond in this way, which is, I think that the courts were and are as unprepared to deal with this pandemic as the rest of us. They were as blindsided as we were. And the pandemic has highlighted holes in our COOP plan, as they call it, the continuing operations plan. Technology is great, but it's still not where it needs to be for us to be able to practice virtually. It's never going to be there. You're never going to replace the human being. And I think that the courts are doing the best that they can, but I think it's hard for them to have to deal with all the issues that are coming up. And to me, when you're talking about dealing with, you know, essential matters, that involves people who are just arrested, who, you know, have a right to be arraigned within, you know, 24 or 48 hours. You know, those sorts of things have to go on. You can't stop those. But other matters can wait. And it's not ideal. It's not ideal for any of us to have to stay home, but it's what we have because of the nature of this pandemic and this disease that we're still learning more and more about. So I do feel for the judges having to find their way through. And I do think that they have other matters that are more urgent and more pressing, which is, you know, another reason why, you know, putting executions on hold just simply makes sense, because these cases do divert the court's attention from other matters, as they should. And, you know, our clients won't be able to get the sort of consideration that these cases call for. That's the same is true for governors. I mean, how does a governor deal with a substantial case for executive clemency when he's trying to figure out how to get hundreds of thousands of people in his state back to work? You know, he has some real nuts and bolts things he needs to do, and he's not going to have time to look at a clemency application, as important as it is. There are only so many hours in a day.
And I think this situation tells us a great deal about priorities. Now, one of the things that we've heard with folks calling in from a variety of different states is, you know, why does a state even consider an execution at this point? A state like Georgia, which has the shortest death warrant period of any state in the country, they can sign a warrant and the execution can be carried out within 2 weeks. The attorney general there, who is very strongly supportive of capital punishment, has said, we're not going to seek death warrants during this period. There are more important things for the state to be focusing on. And when it comes to whether to carry out an execution now, I think one of the images that comes to mind for me is that you don't, that this isn't a question of are you for or against the death penalty. It isn't even a question of whether a particular prisoner whose execution date has been scheduled should or shouldn't be executed. In many respects, it's a question of, is it more important for the state to attempt to kill that prisoner now in circumstances that would place many other lives and the health of many other people at risk? Or is the state's priority safety first, health first? And then we can get back to whether or not we're going to have a death penalty, whether or not we're going to carry it out once the public is safe.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, the prisons aren't prepared for carrying out executions. And so again, if you get to just the mechanics and logistics of how to carry out an execution, how is that going to work? Does everyone have to wear masks and gloves? There's no way to social distance in the witnessing room. I mean, I just think that it would be a debacle and a huge distraction when somebody goes in Tennessee, and I think it's true in most cases, when an execution date is set, certain period of time before the execution, the inmate is moved to, you know, death watch. And I think in Arizona, that's 30 days in advance. In Tennessee, it's 3 days in advance. And it takes an enormous amount of time and staffing to deal with those death warrants and death watch. Not to mention what it will do to our clients' families. Right now, they can't visit their loved ones. Their visits have been cut off. And we face the very real possibility of clients being executed without an opportunity to say goodbye to, you know, their mother, their father, their brother, their daughter, their son, and be deprived of their spiritual advisor. Because most clients have a spiritual advisor who is outside the prison. Very few clients actually use the prison chaplain as their spiritual advisor. And, you know, Tennessee is a heavily Christian state, very religious. And I think that it would be offensive to most Tennesseans to know that men who are about ready to have their life taken at the hands of the state in their name would be deprived of that opportunity to take last communion with their priest or to say a final prayer with their spiritual advisor or have their spiritual advisor prepare them for death and what that means to them in their particular faith practice.
And this is not an abstract matter. Earlier this week in the news, a spiritual advisor for the Texas prisons died from the coronavirus. And so it's a matter of life and death. It's hard to imagine how a spiritual advisor would turn down a request to see someone whose life is about to be terminated by the state, and yet you can't put somebody in that position.
Exactly. I mean, it is, like I said in the motion and have said many times during this conversation, this is something unprecedented. And we hope it never happens again, and we're all doing the best that we can. But this is one obstacle that can be removed. Nobody has to be executed right now. Nobody has to be executed this year. Let's get through this pandemic. And then, you know, if we want to fight about whether or not somebody deserves to be executed or not, we can do so then. But right now, to do so needlessly puts lives at risk.
Well, Kelly, this has been a fascinating discussion. Before I let you go, is there anything else that you would like our audience to know that we haven't covered?
Oh, I'm sure I could go on and on all day. As you know, I never give a short answer, but I think we've covered it all today, Rob. Thank you.
Kelly Henry, it has been a pleasure to have you on Discussions with DPIC.
Take care.
To learn more about the death penalty and the effects of the coronavirus on death penalty cases in Tennessee and elsewhere, visit the Death Penalty Information Center website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to make sure you never miss an episode of this podcast, subscribe to Discussions with DPIC on your podcast app of choice.